If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi there. Welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is J.J. Mull. I'll be your host for today. I am very pleased and excited to be joined by not one, but two folks today, Saki Slonim and Richard Billow, to be talking about their book, Changing Our Minds, Richard M. Billow's Selected Papers on Psychoanalysis and Group Process, out from Routledge just in the last year or so, and written by Richard and edited by Saki with some really thoughtful introductions. And so we will jump into the interview soon, but just briefly by way of introduction, Saki Slonim studied philosophy in the critical rationalist tradition before becoming a clinical psychologist. He maintains a private practice in New York City and is an adjunct professor at the doctoral programs in clinical psychology at the City University of New York and Pace University, and at the postdoctoral program in group psychotherapy at Adelphi University. Richard Billow is a clinical psychologist and holds postdoctoral certificates in psychoanalysis and group psychotherapy. For many years, he directed the postgraduate group program at the Derner Institute at Adelphi University, and he is a frequent contributor to psychoanalytic and group literature, the author of several books, most recently, Changing Our Minds, the book we'll be talking about today. He is a clinical professor in the postdoctoral program in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy at Adelphi and practices in Great Neck, New York. So it's usually the case on this podcast that we sort of start relatively broadly with the simple question of, you know, how did this book come to be? Why this book? You know, which I think for the two of you in particular is kind of a relational question in a way. You know, how did this collaboration come to be? How did the two of you meet each other? You know, how did this book come into the world? Do one of you want to get us started?
Saki, why don't you get us started?
Well, I think it was suggested by Earl Hopper, who was the editor of the series. He suggested to Rich that he compile a book of selected papers, and then he asked me if I'd be interested in editing and contributing introductions, and Yeah, I think that's pretty much how we started. Then we were trying to see how we could, you know, with selected papers, there's always a question, how do you have something that really, A, that reads fresh, and B, that, yeah, that has kind of a good sense of coherence. So that's what we were working on from the beginning, and I think that's how we landed on the Changing Our Minds, which is really talks about how the idea that in every clinical hour we'd like everyone to be changed, including ourselves.
Well, yeah, but the reason why I picked Zaki is I actually invited him to do a book review for the International Journal of Group Psychotherapy, and I was very impressed. And then we worked together for a while, supervision. He was supervising me, and I could see that he had a good sense of what I'm doing, and I thought he'd be a terrific editor, and he was. And it's a lot for, you know, a junior to edit a senior and to be hard-nosed. And I thought he was. So I enjoyed working with Zaki.
You felt like he both kind of saw you, was able to sort of distill your work in a way, but also was able to sort of
really
push
yes,
you as
I
an
think,
editor in a way.
Or yeah, kind of... and simplified some ideas that in rereading took me a little while to catch on to what I was doing. So I thought we had a nice dialogue.
Well, that actually, I mean, that last thing, it sort of maybe leads well into sort of the next set of questions of kind of what, figuring out what it is or what it was you were doing. And so I'd love to hear from both of you, maybe just sort of broadly kind of what you were sort of hoping for from the book and kind of how you think it sort of enters into a broader conversation in the field. And we'll get sort of into the nitty gritty later, but maybe just broadly, you know, what were you hoping to contribute?
Well, for me, it was sort of the history of my intellectual growth as an analyst and a group analyst. And when I started writing, I don't think Beyond had the intense interest that he has now. And certainly applying some of his later ideas to group psychoanalysis was something new, because the Beyond link to group really was mostly from his, you know, his group book. And he moved away from doing group work. He came back to it in later, one of his last books of the metapsychological series. But to really try to translate Beyond's theory of thinking and apply it to an object relations approach, that really excited me. And I'd done a little work with Beyond and more with Jim Grotstein. So, you know, the whole project was part of my own growth as a thinker. And I felt that Beyond had an object relations theory that had a lot more depth in terms of metapsychology than what was happening in relational theory at that time. And I still feel that way, that it, you know, it encompasses a large realm of data. On the other hand, Beyond has had a lot of the classical attitudes, as we know, you know, and he was an autocratic therapist. I wouldn't say he was a relational therapist. I think he was a relational, he kind of a precursor of a relational theory, but certainly not his persona or the way he worked in group. And I think in, you know, what people write about in psychoanalysis and what they do are very different. And, you know, having spent time with Jim, who was in analysis, and Jim's wife was in therapy with Beyond. So, you know, you got to see what actually happened in the consultation room. And I think he was a lot more human than his persona. But anyway, that was the start. And, you know, the journey has continued for me. I've been very interested lately in some of the French ideas in subjectivity. A recent paper in the Quarterly on Laplanche, and linked that to relational theory and to group work as well.
That's very exciting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll certainly, you know, we'll get a little more into the beyond a little bit later, but it does, you know, feels worth noting what you just said actually about kind of the ways in which, you know, certain theoretical precepts, you know, don't always necessarily map on directly to kind of what's happening in the room. And I think something that I really appreciated about the book itself actually is it was very, or is very, you know, of course it's quite theoretical, engages theoretically, but largely seems to sort of ground itself in the kind of mess of the clinic, you know, and sort of the kind of gritty, messy, confusing realm of like the group itself. It's, you really bring it back to the clinical material.
I know. I'm a frustrated novelist, so this is the best I can do.
Yeah.
Well, but it comes alive for me. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. Saki. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that drew me to Rich's work is that I think he has a real talent for describing clinical work in ways that are, you can really sense what's happening in the room, and you can really hear what the what he's thinking and feeling and how he operates. I think that's a real skill, and I think that really is appealing. I wrote about it in the introduction that I came to him after reading his previous books, and I said that I feel envious. And he said, you know, why envy? Why not just jealousy? You know, why can't you have it too? So I thought that was, you know, both. It was a way to show how he both really thinks Kleinian all the time, and also brings it into very much into a personable, down-to-earth experience, which is, you know, I think that's really a skill that a lot of us work a lot to get to.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Certainly. Yeah, I mean, sort of segues nicely to the next question I had in mind, which it is sort of the first section of the book deals in a lot of ways explicitly with kind of the role of the group facilitator, the therapist, you know, kind of gets into questions of self-disclosure, use of self, in a way that, just as you were sort of just speaking to, Rich, I think really kind of both draws from both Bionian and relational precepts and ideas, but also kind of torques them in a very particular way. And just as you both were indicating, I think the book gives a sense both of, you know, Richard, your ideas about sort of facilitation and group facilitation, and then also gives a real felt sense of your particular idiosyncratic stance or style. So I wonder if we could just talk briefly about, you know, that first section of the book and how you think about, you know, broadly the role of the group facilitator. You know, it's a kind of a big question, but maybe both of you could take a stab at it of, you know, how does this book take up the sort of the knotty questions of sort of what it is that the facilitator can or should do?
Well, do you want to say something, Saki, or should I?
I'll just start with the title of the first section is "It's All About Me," which I really think it's one of the better titles that Rich has had. I've been critical of others.
Now this one's hard to beat.
But it really speaks to this notion of how the as the group goes on, the patients or the group members are always have one eye on what the group leader is doing. And this can be in terms of what he's saying or she's saying, or even facial expressions, silence, all of it. So that's, and then I think it expands to this idea that, goes against the notion that as the group develops, the therapist needs to recede more and more into the background and the group does the work itself. And because it says the opposite is that the longer the group members are with the group leader, in a way, he becomes more and more important. Just like in analysis, the transference is more is deeper, and even if people have been with the group for a very long time, there's still the importance of the leader continues. That's at least one idea from that first section.
Nicely said. Yeah, let's broaden this though to look at the work of not in group but of psychoanalysis. I think it was Raku who said that transference is the patient's view of the analyst's countertransference, which is another way of saying the same thing, that the patient is always struggling. What do you think of me? That's really what Racker's talking about. This ties into a whole different approach. I shouldn't say a whole different approach, but LaPlanche's idea of the enigma, you know, and also it gets back to the idea to, you know, the desire to be desired. So there's, you know, there's a zeitgeist that these ideas relate to one another. But the, you know, who is the other? And what, you know, how can I be the object of the other's desire? I'm sort of translating Raka into Lacan, although I think they're, well, maybe Lacan read Raka, but I doubt vice versa. Now the issue is, what is your countertransfer, and how? And you know, by definition, it's unconscious, right? But we do have derivatives, and this gets us back to LH and K. You know, how? What do I feel towards the analysand, or to the group, or to a group member? You know, what's going on in this session? And here again, I think that basic question, you know, how am I linking to the, you know, the patient? That gives us some sense of, you know, well, what's going on with me? And now, of course, some of what's going on with us does relate to what's going on in the room, you know, what's coming from the analysand. But not always. Well, I shouldn't say not singularly, because, you know, we're going through a stream of life as well. And that's not necessarily negative, because, you know, the dynamics of a relationship are always changing according to time and the political world, the, you know, mood, the weather. So, you know, these are all dimensions that go into LH and K. Why am I interested? You know, my curiosity. Why does it go to this dimension and not that? So, you know, you could spend a great deal of the session kind of trying to figure out your, you know, what you're feeling, how that's impacting the, you know, and I don't think one negates the other. I mean, it's all about me. It's also all about the other. And you know, even the title, really, I think Saki came up with the title, that through that interaction, you know, there's something is a learning experience for both partners. And some of it, I mean, a lot of it, I don't think is conscious. I think that every session changes us in some way, just the way this podcast will or is. And, you know, we don't exactly know how, but I think if we're doing fairly good work, we are growing and we're maturing and we're better people from the process. But again, you know, we can't expect to write it down in a, you know, what I got from my summer vacation, you know, what I got from the this hour. But I think over time, we probably develop some wisdom from being in thoughtful relationships with others. And I think that goes, you know, patients will say, well, I don't think I got anything from the hour or from the group, or, you know, and say, well, you could be, I mean, no refunds, but you could be right, or you may not know. So,
yeah. And again, I mean, it really does come through in the writing in a really beautiful way. I mean, I think particularly in the sort of case examples, the I feel like you give a really kind of experience near account of your own kind of negotiation of that coming into a particular kind of knowledge, which does, I mean, you kind of dropped a little bit the reference to LHK just now, and I wonder if it would benefit us to sort of press pause a little bit there and, you know, burrow into some of the Bionian concepts. You know, as you said, Bion's kind of having a bit of a moment right now, but I do think that there are, you know, a lot of pieces of his work that still haven't quite entered into sort of the broader discourse of the field right now. So I wonder if we could just take a moment for folks to just clarify some terms maybe. So maybe start with that, since you sort of dropped the seed of LHK. I wonder if perhaps one of you could sort of start with a broad definition of that cluster of concepts.
Sure. Well, one, just a comment, a contextual comment about Bion and his moment. So certainly in the psychoanalytic world, he's been incorporated by, you know, Freudians and relationalists and everyone. But in the group world, not so much. And if you look at Yalom's book, which, you know, some people consider the Bible of group therapy, in the latest edition, I think maybe there's a paragraph in like a 600-700 page book, there's maybe a paragraph about Bion, so he's really not that central in the group world. So it's just in terms of context. And then I think what the main focus that I think Rich has brought in terms of Bion is the emphasis on emotional truth and the search for emotional truth and how much that's something we crave. And I think once you start listening to that in any session, you see how much, and that's also why people really get a lot out of group, because they feel like they're getting an experience of emotional truth and powerful emotional ideas that you don't have as much, that are harder to come by. Now, L, H, and K. So L is love, H is hate, and K is knowing, or the desire to know. And I think the main conflict for Bion is the conflict about whether or not we want to know things, and especially whether or not we want to know about our painful experiences. So that's the central conflict. And if once you start thinking about it, you'll hear it in every session when people say things like, "I didn't want to think about it," or "Let's talk about something else," or "I don't know what to talk about." All of these can be, I'm sure that's a common experience with people. Patients have come into the session and say, "I don't know what to talk about," and you can really understand that as in terms of how much they want to think and know about their internal experience.
That gets us to, I'm going to come back to LHK, but Saki moved us to another core concept of BEYONDS, which is the PS to D exchange. These are there are a few symbols that I think, you know, important. I don't like a whole series of equations. And actually, BEYOND tried that in his grid. He tried to put everything in a mathematical table, and he said it was a failure. But PS to D gets us back to Klein. And I think Saki's right. I mean, I think the core 20th century psychoanalytic thinkers, the core people, I would think after Freud would be Klein. I think more and more people accept that. I mean, this Klein in Lacan has roots in Klein, LaPlanche, and certainly BEYOND and Winnicott as well. So the idea that thinking hurts, and that was another phrase that I like. I think it's very, you know, it condenses something very important. And what BEYOND said is that, you know, it's both depressing and persecutory. Actually, depression is persecutory. And when you're paranoid, it's very depressing. So there's the equation. But getting back to the nature of thought, you know, one, it's painful because you're breaking an old set. You know, you have to give something up. So that's depressing. You know, we're saying goodbye to something. So it's really not truth. It's emotional truthing. You know, we're not looking for truth because once we have a truth, it loses its vitality. So, you know, we're a constant, it's a journey. So we're giving up something constantly. And the idea of needing to think, you know, that weighs on you. And that's the persecutory part. You know, why do I have to do this? Why, you know, and, you know, the temptation to go to a place, you know, who are my parents? You know, do I really want to look at that? You know, it's a constant mystery because there's a part of us that is always the infant or the child, you know, an early developmental stage. And even though we might be a lot older than certainly me, then, well, my mom is still alive, actually, but my dad died fairly young, so I'm, you know, but he's still in some ways the, you know, the father figure. So, you know, you never quite know who the other is. You know, who are you married to? You know, you thought you knew, but then you have to think about this all the time. And it's a painful, you know, in some ways, because it's painful because she never rests securely. So that's the PS to D that is linked to LH and K, which I want to get back to, because they relate to each other. We don't just love, because if we think, then we're, who is this, you know, why do I love this way? What, you know, who do I love? What's that about? And it's, you know, that's the beauty of the great poets. They bring a lot of ambivalence to their feelings. Now, hate, it's really, I think Winnicott talks about that in a down-to-earth way. You know, it's really not hatred. It's the, what do you do with aggression? What do you do with, you know, in a sense, we have to bring age to our own ideas or else we never develop. You know, we have, and that's one of the nice things about working with an editor like Saki. You know, he will challenge, and I have to then deal with his aggression against something I wrote, let's say, or the way I phrased something. So, LH and K are linkages to others, you know, and in the Kleinian sense of the depressive position, we gotta integrate all these different emotions together. Now, in addition to LH and K, we have minus LH and K, which is important too. And this gets back to what Saki was talking about, the, you know, do I want to think? You know, there's thinking, there's anti-thinking. These are some of the ideas that I brought to the first book and and some of the analytic papers as well that were in the Quarterly and Contemporary Psychoanalysis. So what would be minus L, for instance? What do you think a minus L would be? JJ, you want to?
That's a good question. You know, again, it's, I think this is part of what's beautiful about both Klein and Beyond, is that there's sort of maybe a overly simplistic desire to be like, oh, minus L is simply hate, right? When actually the two are sort of in dynamic interplay, and it's actually precisely, you know, that's not it at all, you know?
No.
Yeah.
Minus L is, it's more like eating junk food, you know?
Minus L would be an over-empathizing with a patient.
It's a kind of like, oh, like I feel for your experience. I'm with you. Oh, I'm so like in it with you. I feel for you.
Exactly.
Good, good.
Yeah. Exactly.
What's the learning experience? Where's the pain? And it doesn't mean that there's never a place for an empathic, you know, joining, but I don't think it's truly empathic to, you know, to love in that way. You know, it's like what they do now with kids. Good job. No matter what they do, good job. You know, kind of minus L.
What, and minus, well, yeah. Well, I'll just say briefly, I mean, it just seems like also you kind of demonstrated that. I mean, I think in talking about your sort of editorial relationship and the way that you really felt Saki like kind of push up against you.
Yeah.
I think that demonstrates like how that interplay between L and H, and that in order to encounter someone, you have to sort of experience yourself as different from them in some way.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, and that's painful. And and of course that's all integrated with the journey for K, but it's not a minus K, which is where you try to again capture the truth, which would be, you know, kind of obsessional holding on to something. I mean, there's sloganeering. These are all minuses. We live in a big minus political
world.
What
is the Eats quote about anxiously reaching or reaching?
Oh, yeah, grasping after. Oh, yeah, what is it? Anxiously grasp. Or is that, I mean, is that the Keats, the negative capability thing? Yeah. Grasping after.
But I want to add something a bit different. On the one hand, you don't want to be excessively reaching for you know, the truth and to get everything in one, you know, right now. On the other, I think there can be, in my mind, in this field, this tendency to say, well, we're just going to wait. And, you know, it will appear at some point. And I think the gist of this book, at least the way I understand Rich, is not that. It's, you know, you don't want to anxiously reach, but you also don't want to just be passive. And so you are trying.
Yeah, well, I developed a concept called the net nuclear idea. It's really a takeoff of Beyond's psychoanalytic object, but it's
selected object or
no psychoanalytic object. Then anything Beyond said, anything can become a psychoanalytic object. Certainly, including your countertransference, anything can be a phrase, something that came up in a session. From an individual hour, from a group session, a dream, a twitch. You know, I notice when I work with you that at certain moments your eyes begin, and I'm not talking about either of you, but I've said this to patients, your eyes begin to, you know, you kind of twitch, you know. So let's see if we can look at this and understand what it's about and what the meaning is. So almost anything, you know. And is it something coming up from the patient? Is it something that I'm doing that causes the twitch? I mean, it can take us anywhere. And this gets back to Saki's idea. I think he was saying that I tend to take a stance. And this is another central idea, I think, throughout my work is I try to share what I'm thinking. I don't play a game of, you know, what do you think I'm thinking, or all that stuff. And, you know, forthright, and this is what I'm coming up with. And I think it, you know, Greenson wrote about it, this Ralph Greenson. I think it was the patient finally says to him, well, I'm not going to free associate right now. I'm going to tell you what I'm thinking. You know what I mean? So there's a place for that where, you know, it's sort of a bastardization of the analytic process. You know, it's not just free association. First of all, it's never free, and it's really never quite association, but that's for another day. But, you know, the idea here is, you know, come on, what's going on? And this is what I think is happening now, you know, agree, disagree, you know, never said I was a good analyst. I just said, I'm an analyst, you know, come to your own conclusions, but this is what's on my mind. And I think that leads to a certain kind of relationship that, I think it becomes more authentic.
It's from a different intellectual sphere, but it fit with my philosophical upbringings, which were about speaking clearly. And, you know, my mentor was Agassi, was a student of Popper's. But the idea was that if you speak clearly, you can be criticized. And if you speak, if you're ambiguous, it's hard to pin you down. It's hard to say what you agree or disagree with. And so I like that in the clinical work too. If you can, you know, it's actually harder to do than to be vague. It's harder to be more precise and speak clearly about what you think.
Harder and, as you said, riskier in a way. I mean, it's risky for both the patient and for the analyst, you know. You know, which it's, I think it's something which I get from this book. It's kind of, I mean, part of what you all are saying, it's like anything worth doing is sort of, there's an element of risk to it. And that's actually part of where the growth happens. I mean, I keep finding my mind going back to this phrase that you brought in, Richard, the kind of the thinking hurts thing, which it's so powerful and really does get at something that I think I really took away from the book that I thought was important, this idea that, you know, I think it's so easy, you know, particularly these days, to get caught into a kind of overly simplistic idea of sort of thinking about thinking as simply a kind of abstract, defensive intellectualization or something, you know, rather than a very particular kind of emotional work, which I think maybe brings us into what I was sort of hoping to talk about maybe in this last bit of our conversation, which again, you know, I feel like we've largely been talking about this the whole time, but maybe would be worth just partitioning out some time again to sort of talk about what we do and how we do it in the session, you know. You know, I think what processes within the group and what leadership interventions help to facilitate this kind of knowledge production, this kind of pursuit of K. You know, I think you brought in, Richard, the kind of the nuclear idea thing, which seems quite important. You know, I'm thinking about the concept of nodules that you bring in, bonding, all of these same like things feel like sort of themes that you bring in the book of sort of the kind of the texture and the kind of material specificity of what happens in the session. So I wonder if we could sort of end our conversation with a sort of a focus on that. What are we doing? How do we do it?
Yeah, all that I think is really important. But I want to emphasize one other piece of this that I think relational theorists, particularly when you read about the European view of American relationality, they criticize it for being stuck in here and now relationships, that it's, you know, it's as if the unconscious doesn't exist. Certainly it's not my view at all. But I want to just mention something kind of simple, which is that I have a developmental perspective. I mean, actually, I was trained in developmental psychology and Piaget and Erickson and many of the other developmentalists, so that I'm always thinking about levels of development. And I don't think of a group, I mean, there is a group theory that the group matures. I really think about the verbalizations, the kinds of thinking that, you know, what do they represent in terms of what, you know, what levels of unconscious thinking, you know, we're talking about, you know, very early. We're talking about some of the latency problems that people have, you know, how does sexuality relate to this? What are the marital problems that are being expressed in terms of, you know, the parents' histories? So that, I mean, this takes us kind of far. You know, the idea of the relationship to the therapist, to the analyst is, you know, who is he or she, you know, constantly, and what, you know, what are the core transferences that are, you know, from early development? So I'm constantly thinking about that in the hour. In addition to all the you know, the material, there's, I guess that's just being an old-fashioned analyst, you know, thinking about development and stages of development and early, you know, patterns of symbiosis. And actually, Beyond talks about that, and we didn't really get to it today, on the container-contain, which is a much different concept than what people talk about, you know, containing the patient, containing the group. They're different types of containing, and you know, so, and there's a kind of attack of the container. So, I mean, this, again, it's too far, but this is what I think about in the hour. Like, what, you know, what's the level of our relationship, both in terms of the alliance, but also in terms of these early developmental patterns? And I think that the role that we play, we take on symbolic features. We become the mother, the father. We also are a sib. You know, we're the not only the competitor, but we're the chum that these are the kinds of things I actually think about when you talk about facilitate. I don't really think about that as much. I just sort of wait and see, you know, what's happening. And I can't say I'm big on planning or facilitating. Like, I do a fair number of demonstration groups, and I just see what captures my interest and my imagination. And I assume it'll be interesting to the other person or to the group. So.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you captured just there a little bit of the kind of, how to put it, I guess the kind of dialectical tension that I think, like, you know, Saki was sort of speaking earlier to the ways in which that sometimes there can be in the field and in the work maybe a little bit too much of a reliance on, like, well, things will happen, things are going to happen, the group is going to do its thing, I just have to be this kind of you know, this parental figure that kind of stands at the side of the playground and lets the kids play, maybe every now and again get in there. And it seems like, Richard, you're sort of speaking to the tension there of, like, there's actually a difference between waiting for something to happen and responding and being present to that process, and a kind of wait and see attitude of, like, well, we'll just let them do what they're doing and trust that that's going to, it seems like you're speaking to the tension there.
Yeah. Because it's a faulty analogy to the playground, because one of the main players in the playground is you. So that, you know, it's not true that you can ever just watch, because people, you know, the patient or the group is watching you.
Well, and as you said, your role changes also at different points. You're the kind
Absolutely.
Of the protective parent, potentially. At times you're the sibling, at times you're sort of the one who sort of accidentally pushes someone off the slide and gives them a scrape. And, you know, you're like all of these things at different times.
I think they're, I'm assuming in terms of the people who listen, there are different levels of experience. And so I do want to bring some things that in maybe more simple terms, because some of this could be very complicated. I think I know for myself, it's very, it could be daunting to think all the things that Rich is talking about, you have to think and feel during the session, seems like, you know, let's go find another job. But you mentioned, JJ, you mentioned bonding. And I think if you, as a, at least in the beginning, if you could think of bonding and meaning making, there's the two main ideas that you're thinking of as a group leader. What's how is my bonding with each member going? You know, and also what kind of are we making? Are we moving towards making meaning? You know, about the relationships, about each person's psychology. So if you could think of those two ideas, bonding and meaning making, that's a good place to start.
Yeah, if you have a, thank you, Saki. I think that's really a good point. A good, as we move towards the close, if we have a bond, we could say almost anything. We have a good bond. If we don't have a bond, we can't even say good morning. What do you mean by that? Or, you know, it can be, you know, you can have a perfectly civilized session and nothing takes place because there's no trust, and which is fine not to have trust. But once you start talking about it, there's the bond.
Oh, it's such an important thing. Or as you were both just talking about the bond, I mean, it is, I felt it in the book that it feels like so much of a kind of baseline precept or kind of precondition for the work is that there is some kind of a bond. And I think for the particular kinds of interventions that you bring, Rich, which can be sort of discursively kind of complicated, can be ironized or ironic or playful or a little kind of nudging or a little, you really do need like some kind of a bond in order for that to even be integrated at all. Yeah.
And part of the bond is as Saki was saying, is to make meaning of the bond, not just to, you know, stay with the bond as, you know,
feel good.
We respect each other. We like
right.
It's
this
constant.
Again is sort of the difference between maybe a kind of, you know, maybe, you know, oversimplified kind of relational theory of like, well, we just want to feel connected. We want to feel,
right.
Or a little bit of that negative vowel, so to speak, the kind of like, well, I just want to feel a sense, a sort of kumbaya sense of connection, but it's actually,
But also it doesn't only go though from bonding allows meaning making. It also the other way around, because once you, especially if you let your ideas become known, you can really, that can make a big impact on a bond. So it goes both ways. It's not just you wait till you have a bond and then you can make meaning. Sometimes you take risks, even in the first session, to see, you know, you often in a first session, you want to see if the person is open to new ideas.
Yeah, and to your ideas. And
to my ideas,
Yeah.
So I am mindful of the time. We should sort of start to ease down, but generally at the end of these things I like to just sort of ask what people are up to these days, if there's sort of any projects in the works or anything that sort of you feel excited about right now, that you'd like to share. Maybe we'll start with you, Saki, and then go
well,
to Richard.
Rich, anyway, he has about an hour until the ski lifts open, so that's what he's excited.
Yeah.
Today, my grandkids are just arrived, so I have to, you know, convert them to expert skiers. So, got a week. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's going to be a very challenging week here. This is in Utah. There's a lot of snow coming. So we'll start with groomers and we'll work our way up to heavy powder. But what I'm working on, there's a well-known group theorist, an analyst in Europe named, probably can't pronounce his name properly, Caius. And I'm writing a critical review comparing his work to mine. We both did experiential learning groups, and his approach to his and compared to how I work. He really hasn't had a critical review in this country. He's similar in some ways to a Pichon Riviere, South American, who also has not had much critical review. So, and they also have theories of linking that are somewhat like Bion and come from the Kleinian tradition of object relations. So I'm finding it very interesting. And I'm also doing some work with LaPlanche, some of his ideas on entelepellation, the idea of, we're kind of imprinted with our identities. Judith Butler's written a lot about that and how that applies to who we are as therapists. So.
To say that I'm working on is big, because as very young kids, it's hard to work on anything. But I'm interested in this word from Dostoevsky that was translated to English as laceration. And he really, in all of his characters, depicts kind of a psychic wound and how it continues to, how it impacts the development of the selfhood. And it's very related to ideas we've talked about, how much there's, on the one hand, an avoidance of wanting to really think about that wound. And on the other, that if you, the more you get, the closer you get to it, it can reveal a lot about, you know, who we are as people, and it really is can be a source of growth and
this gets back to the resurgence of trauma theory, that was neglected in so many years in terms of just unconscious fantasy, which where Freud ended up, but the original seduction theory that he rejected for various reasons. That's what the enduring impact of the wound of trauma, and it's not usually a singular event, but the accumulation of the way we're raised.
So important, fascinating stuff, and we'll eagerly be awaiting both of your things, of course, and no rush, but I'll be eagerly anticipating. In any case, it's really lovely to talk to you both today.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking the time.
You.
Good luck
on
slopes today, Richard, with your grandkids. Hope things go well
there.
And take good care. Okay.
Thank you, JJ.
Thank you very much.